This is a one discussion on an essay by Wendell Berry. It's contained in a book in the bookstore called The Gift of Good Land, and the essay is entitled The Reactor in the Garden. I told you a little bit about it 2 days ago. Let me just tell you for a minute or two about Wendell Berry. I'm an unapologetic disciple of Wendell Berry. I had discovered his book. My sister and her now husband loaned me the book and said, read this if you're thinking about farming or living in the country. And the book was such an exhaustive and, for me at that time, a devastating critique of the way I had been thinking about rural living, and a lot of issues that I hadn't even thought about and their connection with agriculture, that I have to regard as one of the most important books I've read in the last 5 years. What he does is make an analysis of our culture here in America from the point of view of an agriculturalist. And it's not something you hear very often, really. There are other kinds of specialists that give critiques of culture, people that make a living being futurists or critics. He is a generalist by his own admission, and he's a farmer and a poet. And the book is an excellent and penetrating critique of everything from sex to work to farming to college educations and the history of the land grant university. Everything that he finds to be impinging and working destruction toward a way of life that he thinks is very valuable to America and to the world. First book I read, the book that the essay is from is sort of a sequel to it. This book is a good critique of culture. The weakness is that he provides no answers. It's just devastating. And he suggests some at the end. And what he does, his way of finding answers, is rather than providing you a model, he finds examples. He prefers the word example to model, meaning that there are many, many different ways that solutions to our agricultural crisis can be worked out. And there's no one model for it, but many examples. And this book is full of those examples. But there are two essays that sort of break away from that. One is the one we're going to be reading, where he talks about gardening as a political act. And then the last one, which for a layman is very, very sophisticated. Let's not use that word. We talked about it last time. It's a theological essay, the only one I've ever read, you know, that's overtly biblical and theological. And he talks about the meaning of the promised land and the covenant that Israel went into in being in the land, and draws very, very exacting parallels to our situation in America. So those might be two good essays to start with. And the other essays will make more sense after reading this book. As I said, he's also a poet, and I have an essay. This is another good book of essays, and they don't have it in the bookstore, but this has some of the more powerful essays that I've read in here. And he takes on the Pentagon in here. The first book I was ever given and sat on my shelf for years without realizing that he had written it was back in seminary. It's called The Country of Marriage. It's a book of poems about the meaning of marriage and land and the earth and fertility. Another couple of books I haven't gotten all the way through. Clearing, Farming Handbook. The bookstore used to sell a small book called Apart, which is a book of poems, and I think there's more that have come out that I haven't read yet. Was it a year ago? I think just
last,
about.
Last summer, I think they used as a theme when they sent it out to all of us.
Which
poem? Is that what you're asking?
Well, James Carroll.
No, I was. That was. I think it was James Carroll. What I was going to say is that last spring, there was a group of us that went to hear Wendell Berry. He gave the Ezra Pound Lecture at the University of Idaho. And he spoke as a poet. Everybody came here to hear his criticism of culture and agriculture. No, it's fun to meet the guy and to see him. He's tall, kind of skinny Abe Lincoln type. This is his picture on the front. And you can see how skinny he is. It was only after I saw him that I began to wonder if this was his picture. He has kind of jowls, you know, for a thin man. It's kind of odd to see it. And he talks in this slow Kentucky accent. And he says can't instead of can't. It's fun to hear him.
What's wrong?
No.
Nothing tall.
He signed my book too, so. He signed everybody's book. It was a fun thing to be able to meet him. Why don't we just go right to the essay, The Reactor in the Garden? I won't say anything to begin to start conversation. Why don't some of you just say your reactions and we'll make it a discussion from here.
I really appreciate the fact that he said that climbing over the fences is, there's a danger in that because it makes it kind of simplistic and it's not a positive action toward a positive state. It's just simply pointing out the negative problem. Mm-hmm. And that it's very complex. I really appreciate that because it is complex.
Yeah. It's interesting that he did it and then qualifies it.
Yeah.
Any other?
That he considered it something like casting a vote where no possibility or place for you to cast your vote is provided.
Mm-hmm.
Climbing the fence.
Yeah, that's similar to other people who have done civil disobedience, saying that that is, given the situation, the opportunity they have to say anything, that's the only way that they can, in good conscience, cast a vote.
A point too that you made, that it can be freeing to spend how much time in jail where you don't have the right to make the choice. You know, that it doesn't help them to worry about nuclear anything because you don't have the choice when you're in jail. And you're kind of freeing. So that's interesting.
That you've cast, the fact that you're there means you've cast your vote.
Yeah. Like there's nothing you can do until you get out of jail.
Wendell Berry was a little quicker than I to discuss nuclear power because I was for it. There's a poem I learned back when I was a chemist. The path of life, he said, is hard and rough because we do not know enough. When science has discovered something more, we will be happier than we were before. I learned that sincerely as a young scientist, but I came to quote it only ironically now, most of the time. Mm-hmm. And I certainly thought that it would be a wonderful thing, but he had his doubts at an earlier time in history.
Yeah. The essay does get kind of specific and deals specifically with nuclear power.
One of the things that is often brought up to the public is that it's too complex for us to make the decisions on. And it's true, it's very complex, but the four things that he lists out are, as reasons, he said anybody could read them in any local paper. And when I started thinking about the nuclear movement, that wasn't true. Not anybody could read in there that no one knew what they were going to do with an old nuke plant. And I thought that was kind of interesting if that's one of his major reasons for being against them, and that was the reason that I began to question that they were even not any good at all. I asked that of a panel that was discussing nuclear power, and they laughed at me.
Because you didn't know what you were talking about?
No, they just laughed because I asked the question, what do you do with an old nuclear power plant? That was the question. And they just laughed at me, and no one answered. And I didn't even hear the beginning of an answer for about 5 years. And finally I read a government document that would take about $3 million or something like that to decommission one. Or no, $30 million. $1 million a year would have to be saved to decommission a plant at the end of 30 years. Now it takes a whole lot more than that.
I like this point about the automobile. Driving in the car going to the plant.
Light switches.
Yeah, we think about the big things, but we don't think about those subtleties that are in our everyday life that we control.
Yeah, he really brought it to the personal level. Two quotes. Yeah, it says our efforts to correct the way things are, we almost always oppose what's wrong with ourselves. And then the personal level too, that there's this public decision made by the power companies and the government that people are expected to sacrifice their health, to underwrite the fantasy of unlimited economic growth. So there's a decision made about individuals by somebody else, and there's a chance for people to make decisions personally that can do that. And the decision-making process, to me, was really interesting. I appreciate what you brought it home.
Mm-hmm. That ties in with what I heard the other day with Frank Capra, Fritjof Capra, saying that the whole model of unlimited economic growth is antiquated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the roots of the problem are personal, and the roots of the solution would be there too.
Yeah. It's interesting, the word roots, you know, it's agricultural kind of image, but that was important to me, in that he doesn't say the problem, or, you know, that the manifestation of the problem is not always personal, but he says the roots are. And I began to think about that in terms of other, you know, critical social issues like nuclear arms, and wondering how one can say that the root of that is personal, you know. The roots of some other large social problems. Not to say the whole manifestation or dealing with the problem has to be personal, but that the very beginnings of it are somehow personal. And that's kind of devastating, you know, to realize that somehow what I do every day contributes to it.
Especially when you try to change it.
Mm-hmm. Don't you think it would take almost a catastrophe, though, to get most people to realize it was personal? Because they want to all their comforts and that.
If it hits them financially, they'll pay attention.
Ah, all right.
Let's say, though, I like to include myself. I think Wendell Berry does.
Yeah. We all switched the lights on.
Yeah. What he says is that when he climbed over the fence, he was not only protesting a public policy, but indicting himself.
Yeah. I thought it was interesting the way you point out that we have considered our body as not being able to use a machine. Expendable. So that jogging is a kind of with all due respect to joggers, but that gardening is a real good way of using your body organically.
To sustain itself.
Yeah. Uh-huh. In every way. Yeah.
Yeah,
it's great.
It's hard. That was a revelation for me to try to think of gardening as a political act.
Yeah.
I mean, does it strike anybody else that way on the surface?
Oh, no, it didn't bother me, because that was something we called victory gardens in the Second World War.
Really?
And it was a political act. We supported ourselves from our gardens so that all of the machinery could go for war. And that nothing had to, that's right. That's how we supported the war machinery.
Interesting.
By having a victory garden. The better it was, the more patriotic you were.
It's interesting. That's
backwards to what he's saying right there.
I think he has a romantic view of national
labor. Well, should we sweat?
You know, there's one trouble with that manual labor thing. You start using the shovel instead of the rototiller, and you get a tennis arm like Roxy.
You're right.
Well, you know, I have to admit that the people I've talked to, and usually a generation removed from myself, who have done it, have done that manual labor, my father included, and, you know, will have left it with no regrets.
That's right.
And
that's
I think
that's not always true with Joe. Things get in the way.
Yeah, well, I know, I've noticed now that he spends increasing amounts of time and gains more and more satisfaction from that sort of work. Mm-hmm. But it makes me wonder about my own, you know, my own lack of, well, I'm just not old enough to have a back bent by the shovel. And I'm wondering how I'll feel in 25 years. I've done a lot of shoveling at Tocoa now.
Yeah. Joel, we have two fabulous guys here, Bob Walker and Sam the mechanic. They're both from the farm, and what's impressive to me is that they're just masters of machinery. And I lived on a farm without machinery, mules and coal lamps, as we said. And when I was a boy, as I mentioned to some of you lately, I wanted to be Tom Swift, the great inventor. Mm-hmm. I wanted very much to take machinery to do the work that I was doing. It was just awful we worked so hard on these 80 acres in Texas. And the modern farm now is gasoline and electricity from beginning to end. And no farmer in good sense would abandon either of them unless he had a lot of money like Wendell Berry to have a little hobby farm and mule.
Hey. Yeah, he speaks to that.
You said something in here about the, for example, our local rural electric co-op publishes a magazine which constantly editorializes in favor of nuclear power. I got so mad at my local co-op newspaper that I called them up and said, don't send me any more of those lies. And so they quit sending it to me for about a year. But everybody in the rural co-op gets it. And it's just loaded with lies about nuclear power.
Yeah, we're still starting with Tom's question. Is it a romanticized view?
Did that speak to you, Bob?
I'm sorry.
No, not really. I don't know. I agree that it is difficult in this day and age to make a living as a quote farmer by using mules and horses and things like that. But then that depends on your definition of what a living is too. You know, Wendell Berry goes in great detail to the difference between agriculture and agribusiness. And, you know, now what is considered farming is agribusiness. Mm-hmm. And there is not much connection with the soil, with the earth, with one end, you know, of a shovel. And it's, you know, it's a difficult way of life, but I don't know that it's a bad way of life to do that manual labor. And you know, like my my father went through that evolution from the very manual labor and the horses through the mechanization. And he was, you know, very much, you know, the new technology is better, things like that. But I think, you know, he was also a product of his time. And everyone said that new is better, and he was fed the propaganda. And now, when he looks back on it, the further he gets, you know, he's retired now, and the further he gets away from it, the easier it is for him to concede that some of the less higher technology was good.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know anything about the people that lose their farms? Are they agribusiness, or is it a combination, or?
No, everybody's losing farms these days. The big agribusiness isn't, because they can just, you know, have tax write-offs and things like that. But you know, it's the small family farm is, I don't know, I think it's almost a thing of the past.
But the thing about the romanticism of all this is, it depends on what scale you come at, and if we each just approach it small, like through an herb garden, mm-hmm. or just planting tomatoes and sunflowers or whatever, it still gives you that sense of belonging to the earth. Mm-hmm. Or it doesn't matter if you have a window box, yeah. or an acre.
Yeah.
Joel, how does Dakota, do they compete with anybody? After this next year or whatever, were we farming wise or for self-sufficiency eventually, or
we're aiming at self-sufficiency, and it can be as simple as well, one of the things we didn't eat any lettuce no winter. We ate sprouts. We can grow sprouts ourselves. We bought the seeds and grew them. We grew a lot of sprouts in order to substitute for salads, and we got sick of them. But it was just being able to say no to some things that are out of season. You know, we didn't have any tomatoes on it. Mm-hmm. 8 canned tomatoes.
What I'm saying is, can a small farm or a farming community like you have compete with Price Buzzer or make sufficient living to keep on going.
Yeah.
Compared to the bigger guys that are probably done.
Yeah. What Wendell Berry says is that if it's purely a matter of efficiency, they can't. But see, he objects to defining the success of a farm solely in terms of maximum production efficiency. He calls that mining the soil rather than.
Yeah. Well, right. The point I was thinking was can you keep your property?
Well, he says that it's not, you know, that to be solvent is one thing one ought to require always of a farm. And he, when I asked him that, I said, how do you get started with farming? He says, well, keep your job and start small. I just finished reading an article about a fellow who part-time, he started by having a part-time job as a teacher, I think, and bought a little farm, planted 2 acres of vegetables, truck farmed it, worked hard, and cleared $4,000. He planned to plant 15 acres the next year, took out a loan for equipment. I think it was a loan for $4,000, and he cleared $1,000 and had $3,000 paying the loan. He took out a bigger loan, a $29,000 loan. The third year, planted 19 acres, and he ended up with $10,000 in the hole and producing less vegetables on that 19 acres than he did on the floor. There's evidence that scale can make a difference in that. And there are people that are making it on smaller farms, but they, you know, they do alter their lifestyle, and that seems to be a critical issue for them too. I still want to get back to Tom's question. Is it just romanticized? I want to get to it by looking at page 167. It says, he advocates what he uses the term a complete action. He describes protest as a negative action and one that can never rise above the level of raising consciousness and protest and producing, well, I forget exactly what he says. It appears to be possible to raise your consciousness forever without changing it, and so keep protesting forever. On page 167, it's, what then is a complete action? It is, I think, an action which one takes on one's own behalf, which is particular and complex, real, not symbolic, which one can both accomplish on one's own and take full responsibility for. There are perhaps many such actions. Certainly among them is a sort of home production. And what I want to ask is that, isn't it true that everything that amounts to that is described as what he calls a complete action, you know, taking responsibility, full responsibility for accomplishing it on your own, it's real, not symbolic, and on one's own behalf. Isn't that always dismissed as romantic? Isn't it all these things, that all these kind of things that one can take responsibility for as oneself, are the old-fashioned or romantic?
Well, I think we have to remember that what he's talking about here is a political action, not a way of making a living. He's not saying that everybody ought to go out and do this as a complete replacement for agribusiness, as a way of supplying most of the export market for the world, which United States agriculture, with all its problems, does. But as a political action and as a way of becoming more independent from the effects of the agribusiness. Okay.
Then it is also not only real, but symbolic too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What is romantic?
Say some more about what?
Well, kind of what we were talking about before. I mean, I agree with that, in that I think in our society, human labor is seen as demeaning, and that if you do manual labor work with your hands, you're somehow not as good as a person who wears a three-piece suit and rides a train to downtown and works there. And I think that's just untrue. But on the other hand, to somehow make an idol out of manual labor is as if that's always free.
What then do you say about the idol of jogging or keeping your body in perfect condition for the sake of keeping it in perfect condition?
Well, I would agree with that. There's lots of other ways to do it that are useful.
Yeah. That reminds me of something that we read Walden, was it last winter? Yeah. And Thoreau made an interesting statement. He said that if I want to go to a neighboring town and it's 20 miles away, I can walk and you can take a carriage and I'll get there before you. And he said that it will cost me only, it will cost me nothing to walk that 20 miles. But if you have to work to pay for the carriage before you can go, I will arrive long before you do. And this was, he was advocating that this, of course, is the simplest way to go. And I think Barry would say that too, that those people who are freed from manual labor have people in much more work, much more laden with drudgery, you know, mining their, working in jobs of drudgery in order to support a lifestyle it doesn't have to do, that manual labor. That for each of us that sits here,
yes,
and mines our turkey out of the refrigerator, there's someone out there feeding the turkeys or picking the vegetables, and we have made those jobs, rather than everyone participating in it to a limited extent, you know, we have foisted that off on what we regard as the lowest members of our society. And there are people. And so in order to say, you know, to say that, well, isn't it, you know, drudgery isn't always good, you know, the lifestyles that aren't involved in that sort of manual labor, you have to recognize that they are. You know, those all lifestyles are involved in manual labor someplace, because there are people working for you. Mm-hmm. And it's a question of whether your, you know, your megabuck salary adequately compensates people who do that work for you. And farmers and farm workers have said for years that it doesn't. That you don't pay enough for the labor that goes into the cook, you know, the preparation and the growing of your food. And that's where agriculture for Wendelberry comes right down to every individual.
I believe that the farm is the one place that is vastly overtaxed also as far as the cost of the services which they receive in return. And industries and residences are much undertaxed compared to the cost of their services.
Right. Okay.
Jack? I think the notion of the romantic lifestyle of it is just the same thing as the grass is always greener on the other side. Something that, you know, something always looks better. But like we were talking last night, it's a matter of your priorities. If it's important to be on the farm and be connected with the earth, then I have to accept the fact that I have to cut the head off the chicken too, and, you know, slit the gut open. You know, I have to take the bigger bag.
There was a vegetarian comment too.
What was it?
Or take your manure,
take the manure and put it on my vegetables, or whatever it is. It's just a symbol.
Can I change directions a little bit?
Sure.
I think that's something that we've lost in the rural culture type things, sense of community. If machines have become very independent of each other back. You know, when they had the farms, the communities would go from one farm to another harvesting each other's crops.
Well,
yeah, but it's, I mean, it was like a
big, that was an old comment.
It was work, but it was also a big celebration type thing. They'd have lots of food, and the kids would all get to play together, and it was just a whole sense of, you know, that wasn't work, that was a way of life, and that was their community and their life.
Still happening.
Not everywhere, but
in Wisconsin.
North Dakota.
Mm-hmm. And you don't think of agribusiness that way?
I don't really like everything to be made sort of political the way Wendell Berry does. My model is St. Paul, and even though I fall short of Paul, I like the sense of what is important. And Paul was a tent maker. He didn't sit around like holding people knitting all the time for the state fair or something. He made tents just in order to be self-sufficient. And he didn't make tent making political. He just simply made a living as he started new churches. But the thing was the gospel. I think that for people to have Tekoa and to make raising vegetables and making a house and having a little sprouting seeds in the winter somehow political is a misplacing of what's important. And if our healthy food comes from agribusiness and frees more human beings to be St. Paul's, why not?
But that's a big if.
And what does it free us to be?
What does it free us to be?
How has the gap between rich and poor been shortened from people being freed up, to do other things? It seems that it's been widened. To me, that's a gospel. It's justice. And it doesn't seem like agribusiness and freeing people up to do other things has alleviated that situation, but made it worse.
Getting rid of agribusiness here and there will probably not help the poor of the world whatsoever.
Neither does freeing up people to not do agriculture, and that's been what our country.
Well, I sure wish a lot more people were St. Paul's rather than knitting and growing vegetables.
And speaking of knitting, this is an old-fashioned thing. We are knitting our garments instead of buying them manufactured.
Home production's on the line here.
But Jim, don't you think anytime you take some action and start living out some values that are contrary to what we get infused in us by television and the whole smear, that's a political act? Because we're saying we don't adopt those values.
You're just Molière's gentleman who suddenly discovered he's been speaking prose all these years. Just a shifting of the vocabulary a little.
I think it's a political act when you start living out values that are contrary to the mass stuff off, you know, the TV and all that kind of stuff like that. I think it's, you start challenging by your behavior what is practiced by it, you know.
It's a
look at Gandhi's spinning. That was a political act.
It's at least an economic act, and nowadays if it's an economic act, it has political effect at least.
Yeah, for some people,
being St. Paul isn't political, why do you spend so much time in jail?
He was having a god in opposition to the Caesar, not because he was competing with the tent makers of Rome.
Although, as I remember the conflict in Ephesus, when he preached a god that required no souvenirs, the little souvenir makers of Ephesus got real pissed off and threw him in jail.
Yes,
that was political.
They were making silver statues of Diana.
Yeah, yes. He said they didn't need that. That was.
How about dying on a cross? Is that a political?
That is so far from raising vegetables.
I just want to make an observation in the form of a question. Do I detect some hostility toward technology in this room?
That's a good question.
I can answer that on my part. It's an unquestioning assumption that technology solves our problems and doesn't cause more of them. Not in technology per se.
Anybody else to speak to that? Is there hostility toward technology here?
We use it 100%. We use technology 100% here while pretending to oppose it. It's like not taking a bath and putting on perfume.
But Jim does have a point. Because if you look around this room, there are a heck of a lot of things in here that are made due to technology. Everything from the speakers up there to the canopy over the fireplace to the candles sitting there.
Yeah.
But Tim, we don't use those to
the chairs sitting.
We don't use those with the assumption that new technology will solve all of our problems and bring in the kingdom.
No, but
we don't follow worship technology.
No, that's not the point I'm trying to make. I'm just saying that Jim has a point in that technology is not necessarily evil within itself.
Okay, not, okay. And Tom's point was more modest than just rejecting technology outright. He said that there has been too long an unquestioned assumption that to solve problems, all we need to do is push our technology a little further. And all he wants to do is question that.
And I think a lot of it is Holman has resisted that by keeping volunteer labor. I mean, a lot of what's done here is done by volunteer labor. I'm not defending.
We make our own electricity.
We use a lot of resources, but we also use human labor in a way that other corporations or even non-profit organizations don't.
We sent out a $3,500 typewriter because it's starting to run us.
Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
What?
Holden had a computer for a brief time.
Yeah. Well, another way of saying what Tom was saying is that we have idealized technology. I mean, that's what you're saying. And unquestionably accepted that what they do will free us up and make us better. And actually, it has proven that it's widening the gap, making things a lot worse.
Look at nuclear power plants.
That's his point right here.
Yeah, that's not technology working for us. Maybe new technology, but I don't see it being any benefit.
I'm sure it's shooting a fly with a cannon.
Tom said that technology doesn't seem to be making the gap between rich and poor.
That's why I said agribusiness.
Yeah. Okay, I had missed that part of it, but on a more general one, I said that myself, quoting some people who have really studied the matter. But I'm not at all convinced that the increasing gap between rich and poor really is because the poor are getting any poorer. I would suggest that perhaps the life of those people who pick the vegetables at rates of pay that are not enough to maintain decent living conditions are a small number of people in the position that most people were in 100 to 200 years ago in the United States, let alone in most of the world now, that has not had technology with its problems.
No, because it made the whole pie bigger, but it hasn't changed the slices.
Well, I would venture that in technological societies, however you explain it, that there are more people better off than there used to be. I think the gap between rich and poor in the Roman Empire, where nobody worked unless they were a slave, was not the good old days.
Joel, my view of American history in one word is this. We got rid of slavery, not from creatures, but because of machinery. And no society can live without slaves. And machines are our slaves. They work day and night. You don't pay them. You whip them. You curse them. You repair them. And they work. They turn endlessly, like a slave that never sleeps. And we cannot live without slaves. And ours are 100 horsepower engines that chug away endlessly. And our thing run by water here that turns our electricity out that never sleeps, unlike a slave. As the number of slaves in the world increases, the life of humanity will be better. I'm speaking of mechanical slaves.
Is it that we cannot live without slaves or that we choose not to live without?
Human beings, when they made this continent, found that in the south where I lived, it was just no fun at all to work out in the hot sun for 20 hours, so you brought those from Africa.
Yeah, they chilled.
Could stand the sun better, and they had rather sit in the shade and watch a black man do it and do it themselves. I had rather sit in the shade and read a book and let a 100 horsepower engine be my slave than do any of that labor myself.
Okay, but what that does is ignore the consequences of both actions in the long run. Depleted resources and, if that slave, that machine is a renewable resource. unending resource that doesn't harm anything else, I can see that as being an answer.
I think
aren't we at the point where now we're running into problems because of that mindset?
The first mechanical assembly line we had was a making of books. And Lutheranism spread through Northern Europe because of books. You, as a village printer, knows that the book put lots of monks out of work who wrote them one at a time. And when Gutenberg did that, undoubtedly there were monks that were thrown into unemployment. You, as Holden's printer, know that you have a machine that turns out copies where 1,000, 10,000 all look the same. Something like coming off an assembly line in Detroit, except I like the subject matter a little better. Would you want to become the Holden scriptorium here and turn out Dan's books one page every 35 minutes?
I don't think
minutes?
That we're saying that all of technology is bad.
One thing that Wendelberry addresses a little later about industrial and technological society that I think is a real important insight is that although things have become easier and more efficient that way, manufacturers have externalized a lot of the costs, not only economic costs, but social costs. Social costs are not considered, and they weren't, and nowadays they are only considered in something like an environmental impact statement. The social cost is externalized, and a lot of the other cost of your books is externalized, and you no longer have to even think about those consequences. Mm-hmm. The thousands of acres a year of trees that are cut down.
They're sort of renewable.
Sort of. Mm-hmm. When you realize that.
He speaks about that in here too.
Yeah, and unless they are, the possibility of renewal is there, but unless we're redoing it, it's just another form of mining, another using up a limited resource. And what we have to realize is that if it is easier for us, we have to kind of look behind the scene, look to the consequences of having a convenience, and find the hidden cost. And that's not easy to do. McDonald's cuts down 7 acres of trees every day to supply the paper that wraps, that provides your napkins and wraps your burgers. 7 acres every day out of the southern states.
Yeah, but they're also involved in growing trees too.
Yeah, they are. They are, and they
not the same way.
And not the same kind of trees either.
Yeah, that's right, and not the same forest.
They're
crops.
Yeah, they're the equivalent of the modern day Angus steer, Yeah.
I think that Tim's question about anti-technology, I've been accused of that a lot at public hearings, but I think that Barry says it right out. And we can foresee this, and we know what's going to happen. It's already happened to us. A nuclear reactor is a proposed solution to the energy problem, but like all big technological solutions, this one solves a single problem by causing many. The problems of what to do with radioactive waste and with decommissioned nuclear plants, for example, have not yet been solved. And we can confidently predict that the solutions, when they come, will cause yet other serious problems that will come as surprises to the officials and the experts. I mean, that's like saying they will be surprised, and we won't be. And that's silly. We're all going to be very surprised at what they do with the nuke plants. We already know what they're going to do with them.
Mm-hmm. And we'll also be surprised at our complicity in that we have, we have been involved in ignoring the costs.
And he sums it up, in that way, big technology works perpetually against itself. That is the limit of unlimited economic growth. And I'm saying that to Tim's question, that technology has built into it problems. And they're serious and deadly.
It's like the atomic testing in Utah or wherever that was, that the government denied that all these people were getting cancer right around the same time.
Right.
And they denied it the whole time.
Right.
I think that one, I don't know if I want to call it a problem, but one thing about technology is that it creates a thing, a machine or whatever. And all of a sudden, it seems like we don't have to be responsible or answerable to what that thing does. Whereas if we had a slave, a human slave, then that's a human being that we have to be answerable to. And then things start to rule us, like the typewriter. It starts to rule us and control us, and we think that we don't have any control or answers or responsibility towards that thing.
Yeah, now that's one criticism in principle of technology, in that it decides what comes next. Technology runs us, and we become like like the machine's reproductive organs. Janet and Christine.
I think, you know, I'm the one, I'm not going to go all or nothing. I'm not going to go no technology or no back to the earth. I think I'm probably a generation behind a lot of people in this room because of growing up where I did, too. And feel lucky that I grew up on a farm and, you know, had pickles and, you know, deep ditches and all that, too. But I think what's more productive for me in these kind of conversations is, well, what do we do now that is in the middle of all that, in with the technology and in with trying to keep in touch with the earth and the justice to other people on our earth that we share with. Mm-hmm.
That there is something in between all or nothing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, Christine and then?
Well, this is still speaking against technology, so it's not really talking to Jim.
Oh.
But at one point in one of his essays, he says, I'm just going to read a sentence, this really struck me. With us, it grows harder and harder even for intelligent people to behave intelligently, and the unintelligent are condemned to a stupidity probably unknown in traditional cultures. You know, I think technology takes away our intelligence. And we still have that, so how do we decide to get...
Christine, this is technology. This pen. I mean, we use technology all the time. I guess the point I'm trying to make is that we shouldn't be at odds with each other on whether technology is good or technology is bad. It's there. But I think there's something called quality within technology.
Okay, you're talking about that we have maybe been too lax in... Right, it's maybe the same point that Tom is making,
yeah,
that we haven't asked certain questions of technology that ought to have been asked. Yeah. We've accepted it uncritically. We should ask questions like, do we want quantity of throwaway things, or will we invest a greater share of our resources in quality? Do we ask about the social cost? Do we ask about the condition of the worker? Those things are not rejecting technology, but it's trying to introduce a moral dimension in it that hasn't been there before. Yeah.
I think that Jim's point helps to me to clarify Tom's point, namely that a great deal of our difficulty with technology comes from the ridiculous thing we've done of making our slave into our God.
Mm-hmm. And that's not only a political question,
that's
a religious
question. Committed that era.
Maybe part of the way that the idea of going back to the land can not be romanticized is that it causes you to reclaim some of your consequences, and maybe we're not able to ask those questions of technology until we reclaim those consequences on a more personal level and had to deal with them personally before we were even able to ask those kind of questions.
That doing some form of home production, like gardening,
yeah,
brings the questions to mind. Yeah, that's a good point. That it may even be a different, it produces a different way of seeing. That once you've grown your own vegetables, you begin to ask, well, how do they make them so green? And you find out that they inject them with color. Or you say to yourself, like it did for me, it says, I will never object to paying $3 a pound for cheese after having made it.
Or once you start separating your recyclables, then you become aware of how much you consume and why and how you can cut back on that.
Yeah, but there are no antique waste baskets because they didn't have any.
I will point out another thing where technology has become the opposite. Everything's subtended to its opposite. The telephone is a great invention. I love it. But now people are having these answering machines, and 9 times out of 10, it's when you let it put on the button, you need to talk to the machine. And the personal thing has just gone out the window, and I just sometimes refuse to talk to the machine. It's going further and further. It's becoming totally impersonal. The thing that was going to increase personal communication has become almost the most impersonal.
Yeah, I've stopped shopping at the Sears catalog desk. Or at the parts department, because I've been in there on many occasions, and it took me a long time to realize what was happening. I would go in there personally, face to face, confront, and they would leave me to go talk on the phone. Yeah. That phone would ring, and here I had made this trip, you know, to make personal contact and to, you know, have a little drawing of what I needed. And it was always cut off to communicate over this technological device. And so,
a related way, the kinds of questions you were talking about that I think need to be asked, urgently with the computer, which is our most recent explosion, and not to repeat that again, but that those questions need to be asked: how it's going to be used, and in what ways do we see disadvantages and advantages?
Yeah.
But having said that, I want to change and go back to Janet's point. And what do we do now? And my question is, how can we find more complete actions as one of the very defines them? And I see a lot of the things, well, I guess Gardner will see it, one of them, and I'm watching a Gandhi movie, I see a complete action in the salt march and the spinning as a political action. And I, during the 60s, the sit-ins, I mean, it served a purpose of being able to do what you actually wanted to do and also being a protest. But in arms race, I don't see that direct way anymore to have complete action that is a protest but is also saying something positive. Not only negative, and that's been a lot of the criticism of John Nelson, is that he's only doing something negative by climbing over the fence and breaking that law. It's not also something positive like a sit-in or a slave being able to vote for a year.
Yeah.
How do you have a complete protest of a nuclear
weapon? I think taking one of Barry's points, the fact that people are doing that in such great numbers indicate that people have found there are very few complete actions to do. And that is the one way to vote on that issue. The idea of tax resistance becomes, you know, one of the most concrete, one of the most immediate ways is that you don't pay for it anymore.
And you channel that money positively somewhere else.
Yeah, he says that. He says that when you create a vacuum by ceasing a negative action, nature, what does he say, abhors a vacuum, and something positive will fill it. It would be worth, do we have some time left?
Sure.
Okay. If we could spend a little time, you know, kind of brainstorming, trying to get into thinking in terms of a complete action, you know, something that you can take responsibility for and execute yourself. What else does he say in 167? To take on one's own behalf. It's not just symbolic, but is real and really a constant thing. Kim?
I have an idea that's akin to gardening, and that's gardening your children for peace and peace education.
Okay.
And then revolt against mom and John and Marines.
Any other, if we brainstorm on how, what are complete actions one can take?
It doesn't work.
Concerning our nation's armaments.
Joel, there's one small skepticism I have about what Wendell Berry did. In the Weimar Republic, where a whole lot of people, socialists and conservatives and many others, distrusted democracy, they took to the streets in protest. The nationalists who became the Nazis and the communists and the socialists, and the streets of Berlin were filled. People felt that democracy was stupid and agitating slowly and voting at the polls was useless. There were over 2,000 political assassinations from 1918 until 1932. Good guys like Wendell Berry and Chaplain Nelson say that appealing through legislation can't work. Let's go to direct action. And I'm for these people. But the very same, for every Wendell Berry, there's guys that go the route of those in the Weimar Republic. Democracy is useless. Let us use that ultimate form of censorship, assassination. So yeah. There is a peculiar pendulum effect between the great numbers of John Nelson's and Wendell Berry's in one age and a decade later, political assassination, because they both have this in common. Max Weber says democracy is slow boring through hard boards, and they want to speed up the process so much.
That's misquoting John Nelson, but he's never said that.
Max Weber.
No, but what you said about John Nelson, he's never said that
the political
process doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. Okay, and Wendell Berry would say that too, because he's been to Frankfort. Is that the capital of Kentucky? What is? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and he all he speaks from experience, talking about the political leaders of his own state who he has found don't always tell the truth. And he's been on the Capitol steps many times and does participate in the political process. That may be one positive action that we could mention in connection with nuclear arms.
Yeah, I have a lot of trouble with voting the bums out, so to speak, because the bum might be in favor of nuclear weapons, but he also is in favor of signing the papers on Protection Island or something like that. And I'm torn between the different views that one person can hold. Do I vote against them because they won't vote the right way on one thing and vote for them because they will vote the way I would on another? And I simply can never vote the right way because it's all in one person.
Well, we only get to vote once in a while, and I think it's probably more important to tell the person in office what they need to do to represent you frequently, issue by issue.
The freeze movement has been a grassroots movement, meaning that political activity has begun at a very small local level. And that is one area that isn't considered very often for political action. And most of it is most people think of political action means writing senators and US congressmen. And the freeze began many of the first resolutions were made by townships, right?
One way here that, well, I don't know if this isn't a complete action, but I really like being informed by Beth about our garbage. Mm-hmm. And when Beth says our compost is up, I think that's really important for us to hear. Mm-hmm. You know, we're wasting a lot of food garbage all of a sudden.
No one will ever tell you outside of Holden Village.
Or hearing how much stuff goes through the store, too, kind of nice. For me, I mean, working over there, and Christine has more, and Gina are more sensitive, but seeing the things go in and out of the store.
Or, you know, we know when Merrill or Dan go down to the hydro.
Mm-hmm. You know who's got to turn the light on when you use your blow dryer. Yeah.
I think one way to get it for brainstorming would be just continuing education. I don't feel very confident in knowing exactly who my congressmen are and who my representatives are. And if you have that basis, then you can go from there. You can letter write. You can make phone calls. You can share with friends just different issues that are up. And it's one way to keep it going.
I've discovered, that connecting yourself with one organization involved in peace work, they'll never let you forget them. You know, the number of mailing lists that you get on, the kind of information that follows, will always keep you informed and penniless.
That's here at Holden before we got
Maybe one thing, like with the arms race, that I know some people have been doing is just like showing films and doing educational kinds of things in people's homes and neighborhood centers. And that seems to me to be sort of a complete type of action. So it's not only protesting the arms race, but it's kind of an attempt at building community among the people in the area.
That's interesting. Yeah. And it reminds me of what Wart, I think through maybe Wartburg Seminary, through something connected with one of our seminaries, there's a photo exchange with Russian Soviet families in the Soviet Union, where you send a picture of your family to this organization. They will match you with the Soviet Union family. They'll get their picture, your picture to them somehow, and they will get the picture of a Soviet family to you, and the only requirement in the exchange is that you keep it present and displayed in your house at all times.
So far, it's a week in NATO.
It's a week in NATO.
Well, you know, that does bring up something that always bothers me, though. When we talk up here, it sounds so communistic and so socialistic that it makes shivers up and down my back because I'm basically really very patriotic and I've been through this whole flag thing and I really like this country and I get really the creeps to talk against capitalism. And it makes me wonder if someday down the pike when they're adding up all the people that are pink, they're going to put my name on the list because I was at Holden, you know.
They will.
And you're right, they will.
They're communists.
But really, if you get grassroots in this country against some big political major thing that's going on with the government right now, you will be called a communist. It's been true for years and years, but it's coming in really hard right now.
So blessed are you and men revive you.
Yeah.
These are the men that sold for dead, never has been called a red.
Jill!
Interesting.
I got a letter last week. Somebody read my paper on accusing me of being a KGB agent.
What? A KGB agent?
I know.
Wonderful.
Northern Minnesota is a good place to go if you're seeking refuge from that sort of thing. Evidently, that it's always been a hotbed of the Communist Party. Always hot, heavy communist vote up on the range. Yeah. Well, I guess it was because the Finnish immigrants came over and they had to work in the capitalist coal mine or iron mines and they're terrible working conditions. And so all the Finns became socialists and communists. There's still a heavy concentration up there. So.
You suppose they're the seedbed of all this trouble we're having?
It's possible.
No, I think they're in the coma.
I have another suggestion in relation to complete action is maybe becoming more aware of alternatives. Maybe this summer, just the whole room here, we have a forum and everyone's sort of against the arms race, and then someone said, well, how many of you have read on alternatives, like non-military defense?
Civilian-based defense.
And you know about the Peace Academy. And there's only a couple out of the whole room, and maybe that's a responsibility to become more knowledgeable about alternatives.
Yeah.
To what we protest.
Yeah. Yeah. And that does provide positive options then. Positive actions to support a peace academy.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean, if we say that it's immoral for Christians to participate in nuclear war, then what can we participate in terms of defense?
Yeah. Yeah. Is there a book in the bookstore, a new one?
Well, Ron Sider's book is the last three chapters are on alternatives like that.
Okay.
And Dan's book gives us a thing that he doesn't necessarily agree with, but brilliantly lays it out on the concept of just war, which by strict definition, in my view, would have to be with modest conventional weapons, not the horrible nukes.
Yeah.
You know, what is modest these days? I won't go into that. But it at least it's not the loathsome radiation.
Yeah.
And that sweet little exocet that knocked the British ship out of the water down there in Argentina, that's real nice comparison. Yeah.
Another complete action, I was thinking about the movie we saw last night, A Men's Lives, role models and such, setting up a family with maybe both parents work part-time for the income. You know, not that men necessarily just lose the notion that they're the breadwinner, but something else has to take that place. What are they if they're not the breadwinner?
Mm-hmm.
What is the mother if she's not, or the woman if she's not the mother or homemaker? You know, think of alternatives for that.
Another neat thing to do, we did this, Lori and I did this once, it was on a day that I was fasting, and she had a plate of food, and just to sit and become conscious of where the food came from. The mandarin oranges here come from Japan. And just to try and figure out where all these things came from and how they got here.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're really good.
They're really good?
Mm-hmm. It still came from Japan. No, she's talking about Japan. Oh, the candles? Oh, but they were
a gift.
I guess they all didn't arrive here either when Jim was picking them up in Seattle. Lost six gallons on the street in Des Moines.
Mm-hmm.
Mandarin oranges.
Oh.
Yeah. What? Jim Martin, he did have a stack of money, and when he went around the corner, he lost it. Some lady's car cracked into 6 gallons of Holden's Mandarin oranges.
Oh.
So.
I was thinking about complete actions and alternatives.
Yeah.
Well, something that's been on my mind a lot, talking economic alternatives, is to have a different vision of Christmas. And this gift exchange, I'm getting more and more turned off to any sort of gift exchange every year. Uh-huh. Even if it's homemade gifts, it's better than store-bought. But our family is having a recycle Christmas, we call it. It's like happy exchange, only without barter.
Yeah.
You just give, you know, your sister likes your skirt, give it to her, you know, if she can use it.
Yeah.
And I have Jehovah's Witness friends that tell me, and I know we all know that Christmas is a pagan origin.
Yeah.
And what could be finer than Christians to really have a radical stand on Christmas and refuse to get into buying and changing gifts?
Yeah. How many people have bad experiences giving Christmas gifts?
There's a new book in the library.
Yeah, there's a new book.
Unplugged the Christmas machine.
Let me share you my good experience. I gave Emily a book one Christmas and she never read it, so the next year I wrapped it up and gave it to her again. And since you give people gifts that they don't use, go into their homes, retrieve the gift, wrap it up, and give it a second Christmas.
There is.
Give
it to somebody else. Wonderful. Great idea. Well,
there's another alternative, though. Seriously.
Seriously.
Giving money in the name of some organization.
Yeah, but you gotta know who you're giving the gift to. When you send a little card saying, I didn't buy you a gift, I gave it to the Bread for the World, and you find out they don't like Bread for the World.
Well, that's consciousness raising.
That's not the point of the gift.
Like purple pies
either.
People want Christians want people to ask us to live while we do any rather one way.
Yeah.
How's the time? Are we? Okay. I think Emily's suggestion for any kind of homework to take home from the essay has to do with thinking of how one engages in complete action. I was surprised when I read this that Wendell Berry went over the fence. I'm not a natural born fence goer over. And I always have excuses, and it was really a jolt and good for me to see that he engaged in it as an important action. And it's forced me to look at the connection between the two. But it's also forced me to begin to look to the consequences of what I do, and to try to seek out those complete actions. And the definition on page 167 is a good guide. He gives a lot of criteria for a complete action. He discusses one particularly, and that is to decrease the use of energy for entertainment. You know. He also mentions that other positive complete actions have to do with home production of some sort, and that's maybe one guideline in which you can think about it. That's kind of a perpetual assignment now. You know, engage in complete action.
There's, if anyone's interested, there is an act of civil disobedience going on tomorrow at 1:15. We're going to climb over.
No, there isn't.
The post office fence, we're going to climb over 1:15.
Yes, there is. The mail will be dumped out on the floor of the dining hall.
Everybody
can scrabble for it.
It decomposes.
Put it in the shredder.
That's
uncivil. Yeah, you talk about the Rax Mansion. This book that Rax mentioned, Unplugged the Christmas Machine, addresses that issue pretty clearly, but also addresses the issue of which Kyle was talking about, two poor families and how, you know, not having time, and that's how we got into it. So there's some resources in that.
Is that in the bookstore?
Yes, it is.
It also does give lists of Christmas gifts you can give to people of various ages, and some of them I just consider absolutely outrageous, and some I think are good. But just seeing the list of Christmas presents you can buy somebody that's 12 years old is just blows your mind away.
Yeah. That's definitely taking the fact that you're obliged to do it at a certain time of the year. You need that sort of.
It is. But I think the rest of the book says that you don't really have to if you.
There's good and bad in it.
Yeah.
And that's a learned behavior. I know Micah plays with pots and pans.
Yes.
And when we go into Toys R Us, 80% of the toys in there are either modeled after movie characters, TV characters, or
It makes it a lot easier to walk by them if you don't have a TV.
Yeah, to try to find toys that are not related to characters dispensed on the media somehow.
E.T.?
Wind-up toys are one good example. They are pure toys.
Yeah, they are.
Complete. Blocks are pure toys.
Yeah,
Lego is.
And they're still the ones that the kids really prefer, unless they're very,
very much. I don't know.
In the early stages, Micah does.
Canvas.
A lot of your Legos comes out as a space station after some. Well, see, that's the one I buy. I've already been conditioned.
That's the problem.
Something else that doesn't have anything to do with presents that is kind of along the same lines is that society says that you have to make money to, in what you're doing. Like, I really enjoy my nursing and life nursing. But why do I have to get paid for nursing? You know? That you have to be an institution type setting thing to do your nursing. It's, I don't know how to explain it any better. That all the money that I made last year went to me because I was enjoying what I was doing.
Well, that's a guilt trip.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. The Bible doesn't talk a whole lot about it, except that it implies in many cases that your work was the work of your hands, and it was. For your day's wage, your pay was described in terms of a day's wage, and it was sufficient for the day. There was no more security than that. And I think Mary's probably mentioned, if she's talked about shalom at all, that when the day workers came back to the square or the market, they'd say, "Is it shalom with you?" Meaning, did you get enough today working to feed your family? And they said yes, and then it was cool. If they said no, then the community had an obligation to make sure everybody was taken care of for the night.